Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcast, we appreciate it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about Fortnite. People trying to tell me it's a sport. Okay. We'll also talk about Jeremy Lin and our next installment of The Right Time Book Club with Lanae O'Neill of The Undefeated. But first, training camp has arrived. NFL training camp has arrived. Yeah. And I don't want to be that guy, but I do think this is interesting. And I'm not the only person, I think, that feels this way. I do feel like training camp seemed like a bit of a bigger deal to me. Maybe 10 years ago, definitely 20, but now it doesn't really like register for me in that way. And I think that part of it is you never really escape the NFL anymore. Like, I think that you had this stretch back in the way that we used to consume sports content where July was basically just baseball, and not just baseball, but like the hardest stretch of the baseball season to really keep going with is the dog days of summer. Even they don't feel like being out there, right? And then training camp would come around and it'd be like some morsel of football that you could have. And in this country, man, people love that football. Since I was reading, I've been reading this book for years. So they just do it in pieces. But anyway, reading this book called Brand NFL. And one, stat they mentioned is that in 1965, that is when football became a more popular spectator sport than baseball was. And I've contended that a big part of why football is as popular the way that it is that basically football is a thing everywhere. Like, we got basketball places, like basketball states, and baseball has largely been a city game throughout its time, and part of why it seems so important, from the 20s through the 60s or 70s is because they had all the best real estate. The football has always connected the map in a way that I would say these other sports have not. Like, it's the thing. And so we consume it all the time now. So training camp is just kind of, unless somebody holds out. And I got to say, recent years had not been as much fun with the holdout as the holdout could be when I was a kid. When I was a kid, it felt like everybody held out. They held out all the time. It's coming back in style, though, now. Your man Le'Veon Bell, he did the whole year holdout last year. We hadn't had one of those. At least it felt like for a minute. Now these cats are willing to take some time off, give us a little bit of drama with it. I appreciate that. And right now, Ezekiel Elliott has said, hey, man, if the Cowboys don't get his contract done, then he's not coming to camp. There's this interesting detail that me and my man Dan sitting in for Gabe today. My man Dan mentioned before we got on the show that if Zeke doesn't come to training camp before August 6th, then he does not accrue a year toward free agency. And that's kind of the leverage that the Cowboys have over Elliott in this situation. And what Dan was saying is, like, you didn't quite understand why it was that that was a thing. And Dan, I think I couldn't answer it then, but I got a better answer for you now. The reason that is the thing is that if he holds out now and he doesn't accrue that year toward free agency, what they know is that he can't hold out next year. So let's say the Cowboys came out here and they went 3-0 or something like that without Zeke. If he's coming back, then he can't run any game on them next year, because then he won't have enough years accrued to become an unrestricted free agent when his time comes up. Like, that's what we've got with him. So that's what the Cowboys are leaning on. What that tells me is this. This is only going to work for Zeke if he's willing to miss some games. And if he's willing to miss some games, I feel pretty confident that he's going to get his money. If he is willing, and I think it's worth noting, able to miss some games. Because not everybody in this league is built to miss some checks. It's not really how it works for most of these cats. They get there when the checks get there. And by the way, to be fair to the players when we make that point, I don't think the owners are terribly different in that regard. Not that they can't miss checks, but they just greedy. They don't want to miss no checks. Like, anytime this lockout thing comes or whatever, the owners ain't trying to miss no games any more than the players are trying to miss games. They're not. They trying to get their bread as much as they can. Now, the whole premise that this thing is set up on is largely based around the idea that players ain't going to miss games. Like, one reason I don't get mad about holdouts and why I look at people funny when they offer a certain measure of judgment about holdouts is that this system is built for that. It's 100% built for that, right? It's built in a way where the owners, if they don't like the contract that they're in, they have all kinds of outs designed so that they can get out of it without having to pay the money. And the way the game is set up is that if the player wants to get his bread, he just stays at the crib. That's how it goes. So if you want to hold out, go ahead. If you want to roll the dice and take that risk, go ahead. Right? You go ahead and do that if that's the game that you want to play. So I never get mad about it because I don't feel like it's a violation of the contract. I feel like it's an understanding of what the overall ecosystem of the contracts happen to be. That this is the bigger system that's in place, and since this is the leverage that the player has. If you want to try to get your bread, then you're just going to have to go ahead and stay at the crib. And if Zeke's willing to do that, or in this case, stay in Cabo, then maybe he's got a chance to get his money. I don't know. I just think the only way it happens is if this goes basically the same way it went with Emmitt Smith in 1992 when he held out, He held out in 93. Cowboys lost two games, and then they brought him in. But what was interesting about that when he missed those two games that I think a lot of people forget, there was a statistic that they kept throwing on TV after that happened, which is very simple. No team that had ever gone 0-2 had won the Super Bowl. Emmitt Smith played in game 3. Coincidentally, they won the Super Bowl. But he was out there for game 3. But that was the thing that was thrown out there. No team had gone 0-2 and then won the Super Bowl. See, now all of a sudden, this was the squeeze on the Cowboys because they wanted to win it that bad. And the Emmitt Smith situation, for what it's worth, is very, very similar to the Zeke one in that Michael Irvin had gotten his money. Troy Aikman had gotten his money. I think Irvin had gotten his money. I'm not sure if Irvin had. Troy Aikman was definitely set. And one of the feelings that was surrounding Emmitt was that, oh, okay, so you'll make sure that you get Troy Aikman his money, even though we got this run-heavy offense and you won't pay me, even though I'm going to be out here taking 350 carries. Okay, cool. I see how it goes. At that time, a lot of the discussion around it was obviously centered around race because it was, duh, Troy Aikman. He may look like Jay-Z, but, you know, he's white. And then you had Emmitt trying to get his bread. Okay. Now we're in a similar situation, though the quarterback is not white. The quarterback is Dak Prescott. They got to figure out how to pay him. And oh, by the way, it doesn't sound like he's so happy about how it's going for him getting his money. Amari Cooper, he is also over there and he's got to get his money. I guess he's kind of in the Michael Irvin situation in this. But I mention that because I don't think the Cowboys just woke up one day and were like, damn, we would love nothing more in this world than to pay Zeke, right? Like, I don't think that's the way they operate, obviously. But I also do acknowledge that they're in a bit of a trick bag because of the salary cap. They got dudes on defense they're going to wind up having to pay. And betting on the future of a running back is typically not a wise play to make. And that's why Zeke got to hold out now. Like, trying to get your money in year 5, like, go ask a dude like DeMarco Murray how that goes, especially a cat that has the ball pumped into his hands as often as is going to be the case with Ezekiel Elliott. Go see how that works out, right? No, what they're going to do is they're going to hold those carries against you, the same carries that they got for as cheap as they possibly could while they had you under contract. So if you're going to get this money, now is the time to get this money because now is the time that Ezekiel Elliott can make the argument, I still have a lot left. If you try to do this after year 5, you might be able to say, I still have something left. And, oh, by the way, if you try to do this after year 5, there's a good chance they're going to slap a franchise tag on you. Like, this is the only time I think that it would be wise for him to go ahead and make this play, if he bought it. And what remains to be seen is whether or not he's bought it. Because most cats that are out here trying to do this and in the NFL in these places, they're not really bought it. They not really ready to be out here and not play the games. Take all the hell that comes with it. Miss the money for not playing the games. So are you bought it or not? Now, when are we going to figure that part out? I'm not exactly sure how exactly this is going to affect the Cowboys' negotiations with him. I'm not exactly sure. Like, are the Cowboys just going to keep on negotiating like everything had been going before? Because the only thing that I can take from the fact that Elliott is not in camp right now is that he and his agent have decided that this isn't going to end the way that they want it to end. How did they want it to end? They want it to end like the Todd Gurley contract. That's what they want. They wanted to end like the Todd Gurley contract. Bro, they're not going to give you that. And it's not even a matter of whether or not you should get the Todd Gurley contract. The problem is it looked like Todd Gurley got arthritis. Like the Todd Gurley contract, which, by the way, looked really good like 9 months ago. In the middle of November, the Todd Gurley contract looked like, hey, you know what? That was probably a pretty good idea what the Rams did. And then next thing you know, people out here talking about he might got arthritis. It's like 25. Yeah, so no, okay. Like, the obvious cautionary tale of the Todd Gurley contract is in front of us. I get why the Cowboys wouldn't want to pay out that deal, but I also get damn sure why it is that Elliott would want that deal. I get damn sure why Elliott would push to get that deal. Now, we're just going to see how hard it is that he's willing to push. Now, how well can they play without him? That becomes interesting. My man Florida James with the stats. Let's get a look at this. Let me turn the phone to the side so all the columns line up right. His first three seasons are, like, the other people whose names are there is, it's basically Hall of Famers and Hall of Famers, borderline Hall of Famers, and Chris Johnson. All right, so since the merger, got 11 players who had 5,000 yards from scrimmage and 30 touchdowns in their first three seasons, right? Ezekiel Elliott is one of them. Here's the rest. Chris Johnson, Adrian Peterson, Clinton Portis, that's my borderline Hall of Famer. LaDainian Tomlinson, Edgerrin James, should be in the Hall of Fame. Terrell Davis, Emmitt Smith, Barry Sanders, Eric Dickerson, Earl Campbell. Here's something else for you from my man Florida James, which is how Amari Cooper has played based on whether or not Ezekiel Elliott is in the lineup. All right, now I got to turn the phone the other way to get these columns to line up. All right, when Zeke is on the field, Cooper's reception percentage is 75%. When he's off the field, it's 57%. When Zeke is on the field, Cooper's yards per reception, 14.9. When Zeke is off the field, 9.6. He has 6 receiving touchdowns with Elliott on the field, none with Elliott off the field. The play action numbers, they are way different for Dak Prescott when Ezekiel Elliott is on the field. When he's on the field, QBR, depending on how you feel about that number, is what you do with this stat. With Zeke on the field, 82.8 for Prescott. With him off, 57.2 off of play action. Off play action, with Zeke on the field, Prescott's completion percentage, 65. Elliott off, 49. 8.9%, 8.9 yards per attempt off play action with Zeke on the field, 6.3 without. Now, I imagine that some of those would be different if Zeke wasn't on the team total, because the Cowboys are still going to have to run the ball, so the play-action fake with the other guys probably sells a little bit tougher. But it is obvious that he is a player who affects what others do. Right? He is a guy who affects what others are able to do on the field. And I know, I understand every argument about the disposability of running backs. That applies to almost all of them. I don't know if it applies to the top three or four. I don't. So like a guy like Saquon Barkley, we'll never really know because I don't know if the Giants are ever going to be good again. But you couldn't just take Saquon Barkley off a good Giants team and I think just reasonably replace him and just be like, oh, okay, cool, everything's going to be fine. We can just go get a running back in the seventh round. Like, you can get a running back in the seventh round. That don't mean you're actually going to do it. Like, come on now. Like, who the Cowboys go sign? Alfred Morris? That's who they sign. And so, like, we were doing our conference call, you know, for High Noon. And the question that I was throwing out there is, like, do you think getting Alfred Morris was a leverage play? Hell no, that ain't no leverage play. He Alfred Morris. Are you kidding me? You serious? Like, you go tell Zeke, we're going to be cool. We just went and got Alfred Morris. Yo, there's a reason you had to go get him. Right, anybody that's good enough to just be like, okay, we good. This is leverage against Ezekiel Elliott. They already got a job. Every single one of them already got a job. That's not what the play is going to be. That's not what it is. I also saw this about Zeke. This is pretty funny to me. He's out there working out in Cabo. Apparently, that's what he does when he's got time. Like, when he's suspended, he went and worked out in Cabo because his agent got a house in Cabo. And they're saying that he's going to work out in Cabo because then, if it all gets right with the Cowboys, he can hop a quick flight to Oxnard, and then he can just go in there and get into practice. And I got to say this. Ezekiel Elliott might be a little bit more disciplined than me. I have never been to Cabo, but I feel like if I'm in Cabo, the last thing I'm trying to do is work. Maybe that's just me. Like, I've always had this grand dream in my life that if I ever wrote a book or something like that, that I would go find some wonderful locale and I would fly there and I would stay like 5 or 6 months or something like that. You know what I mean? And I just kick it around and I write the book and I clear my head. Like, it's always kind of like when people talk about they go to these other places to record albums, you know, like I'd always had that vision in mind to be like, oh yeah, you know, I could take in and the vibe of the place will be there and I will be separated from every, like all these things I have in mind. Man, if I ever said my plan was to go to Cabo to do this stuff, bro, I'd never leave. Ain't no way in the world. I'd be like, man, I ain't doing no work. Why would I do that? Especially, I mean, I'm looking around, see if anybody close, but hey, man, we done seen Zeke's movies. Zeke be trying to kick it, you know? So, hey, maybe he'll get it all done. I don't know, right? Maybe he'll come back in tip-top shape. I'm just saying that young man possesses a discipline that I do not. Because I would probably not be coming in tip-top shape. No, I would probably be coming in looking like I had been kicking it in Cabo. That would probably be my plan. That would be what I would do. Now, let me ask this question. This is where it gets to be interesting. So Dak hadn't gotten his money yet. Dak's looking like he's in a position where he might get, like, the biggest quarterback contract anybody's ever had. Timing's fascinating. But Dak's trying to get his money. You know what would really help Dak get his money? Having Ezekiel Elliott on the field. I just rattled off the numbers for you. It would really help to have Ezekiel Elliott on the field. But the more money Ezekiel Elliott gets, probably less money for Dak. If I'm Dak, I would really like it if whatever they were going to do to sign Zeke, they did it before the season started. So that I could then go out there and get my money because I'm playing with Zeke, as opposed to the Cowboys throwing Zeke out there, or not throwing Zeke out there, and then Dak's out there without him, and then he looked like boo-boo, and then that makes them not want to give him his money. Amari Cooper, we rattled off some of them numbers for you about what happens when he's playing for the Cowboys, but Ezekiel Elliott is not on the field. I mean, I'm just saying. They going to mess up these other cats' money by not giving Zeke his money, but then they give Zeke his money. They going to use that as a reason to not have to give these other cats their money. And the dude they really got to give the money to is Cooper. They really got to give the money to Cooper if for no other reason than to justify giving up that first-round pick, right? Like, you could only give up that first-round pick to get Cooper because you knew you were going to extend him. Like, that was part of the plan. That's the only way that can really work. That's how that goes down. That's how you make that trade. That's how you feel good about it. And people have to justify sunk costs all the time. I don't blame them if they do it in this case, just to be clear. But this is a larger understanding of the way things work in the world. People feel the need to justify those sunk costs. All right. That's what they're going to probably need to do with him. But he's the cat that's going to have to get signed. Dak, a little bit different. They can play this thing out. And then they can play the franchise tag game with him. Now, do they want to roll the dice on the idea that they can just go get another Dak Prescott? You never know. They got him, what, in the fourth round? Jerry is the type that might convince himself that he could go get him another one of those in the fourth round. Never mind the fact that what Jerry wanted to really do was to trade up to get Paxton Lynch, which would have been a horrendous idea. Let me tell you something. If they had made that move to go up there to get Paxton Lynch, you know who would be the quarterback of the Cowboys right now? Tony Romo. Tony Romo would be out there with a cane. Playing quarterback for the Cowboys, because that would be the play that they would have to make. That would be the dude they would have out there. It would be Tony Romo if they had messed around and they had, like, drafted Paxton Lynch. That's what it would have been. Everybody wants their money. Everybody gets more money if Zeke plays. So some people might get less money. All I'm saying is the Cowboys are pretty fascinating if you like pocket watching. And I don't like pocket watching, but okay, I'm doing a little bit of pocket watching right now. We should probably just talk about something else. So, interesting thing in my life of sorts is that I work with someone who is very good friends with Jeremy Lin. And I have to be careful about this because my buddy who works with Jeremy Lin has a tendency from time to time to kind of dramatize things a little bit just because it's his buddy and it's kind of funny, you know, to do those things, right? And he has this big thing about, like, Asians, you know, Pablo. Anyway, so I have to be careful when I talk about Jeremy Lin because I am, to a degree, in a habit of kind of downplaying whatever it is he does or he is doing, because it becomes kind of like part of the dynamic that I have on that television show, right? And so I've been working on that as we deal with this latest Jeremy Lin story. And so Jeremy Lin went taking a trip to Asia, this trip he's taken for 6 weeks. And, you know, he's going there as an NBA champion. He won a championship with the Toronto Raptors. And as you might imagine, he's kind of a big deal, like especially in Taiwan. He's a really, really, really big deal. Like, this is a part of the world that really enjoys basketball, but doesn't really have, like, it doesn't really produce basketball players like that. And by the way, I find that to be an interesting juxtaposition of a lot of countries in the world versus the United States, which is to say that as a nation, like, we only really care about sports that we play in the United States. Like, there are plenty of American soccer players who are Jeremy Lin caliber guys in, like, European soccer leagues. You know, they're about that. In fact, better than Jeremy Lin is at their respective sport than Jeremy Lin is at his. Like, I think there's a handful of guys like that. But none of them are then going to be like super beloved stars in the United States the way that Jeremy Lin is in Taiwan. And he ain't even grow up there, right? But that's just because as Americans, we're so insular. We care about the games that we play here. Like, ain't a whole lot of sports that we care about in the United States that we did not invent. Like, if we ain't come up with it, it don't really count. Like, there's just not a lot that we are into in that way. But Jeremy Lin is huge in Taiwan. He's huge over there. And so he's there and he's speaking at a Christian event. And, you know, Jeremy Lin is a very devout Christian. So he's there at this event and it turned really emotional. Like, he just kind of unburdened his soul here for a minute. Check it out.
And in English, there's a saying and it says, once you hit rock bottom, the only way is up. But rock bottom just seems to keep getting more and more rock bottom for me. And so free agency has been tough because I feel like in some ways the NBA has kind of given up on me. And I always knew if I gave anybody a reason to doubt, they would.
You know, one thing about this, and that part has been excerpted and sent, and I haven't seen anywhere the full video. Like, Dan, have you seen the full video of this?
No.
Okay, like because I'm curious what was going on before this, right? Because when we get the video, he's in full tears already. You know, and he said something later in there that I thought was interesting where he was just like, I just feel like whenever I come to talk at these events that I'm just talking about my pain. Which, for whatever reason, being at those events moves him as such. Now, I readily acknowledge I am not a religious person in any way, Christian or otherwise. So there perhaps is something about being in a room under those circumstances that brings it out of him. That's something that I personally can't relate to because I'm not that guy. That's not what I do. But I found it interesting that he said that he felt like when he's doing that, and he said that, you know, he knew that he was going to have to take this trip to Asia and that he was going to be there for 6 weeks. And he really felt like that he was going to have to fake it, that he was going to have to like fake a smile for everybody because of like what his importance is. I mean, I'm gleaning that last part because he didn't say that explicitly, but just kind of like what his importance is there. And he said something about how he won a championship that he feels like he didn't earn because he wasn't like an active contributor on the team. And I felt bad for the dude, if for no other reason than it's obvious that his pain is real. Like, you hear it and you feel it, right? Like, his pain is very, very real. And I imagine also that it must be very difficult if you think that you are an NBA caliber player and what you really want to do is to play in the NBA and there's no one who is particularly interested in you playing in the NBA. And the way he put it was he said he just feels like rock bottom just keeps getting farther down. And that's why I wondered what he was talking about beforehand. Because it's one thing to say that not generating interest from NBA teams is rock bottom. And I can see that, right? I can totally see how, like, how that feels like the end, how that feels like the worst. And I know he suffered some injuries and stuff, but I'd really kind of like to know what before that he was talking about that felt like the bottom for him. Because what I think is tricky in the reception for some people, and I don't want to use everybody else as a shield, I think part of it for me that's difficult for me to take in when he's talked about this is, dude, you had a run. And what you get playing in the NBA is a run. And his run was as strong as any run that most of us could think of. He's 30 years old. Like, now's about the time that it's over for most guys of your standing, most guys of your caliber. And one thing that I find interesting about professional athletes, when you talk to more and more of them, especially role players, is when they realize, okay, this is what I got to do to stay in the NBA, right? Like, this is going to be my thing. And then they do it, and they get in there, and they look around, and they see the, like, the young guys, and they see what the overall level of talent is and stuff like that. And I actually find that most of those guys, they are far more self-aware about their athletic mortality than people give them credit for being, because they look around and they realize what they have to do to survive. And I think part of what caught me off guard about the way that Lynn responded here was that it didn't sound like he had that perspective. And I don't mean, like, I think people, like, throw the word perspective around at other people kind of as a judgment. Like, you had the right perspective. I'm not talking about the right perspective or the wrong perspective. I'm talking specifically about that perspective. Right? Like, specifically about that one. Because I would kind of think that there are some guys, and Lynn's not one of them, and he doesn't have to be one of them, but some guys, I would think, would have the run and the career that he had and would then cap that off by being a member of a championship team and then look around and see there wasn't a market and be like, you know what? I had a good run. That's not how this hit him. It's not at all how it hit him. And I think that's, I don't know, I find that to be, like, really interesting that that's just not how it hit him. Like, I think it's in part because he wants it so much in these games. Like, something like this is kind of irreplaceable. Like, you're not going to find something else like playing in the NBA. And I also think there's something from talking to Pablo that was just kind of an interesting perspective on this, which is Lynn really, really, really wants to be respected by his peers. He wants to be respected by the league. He wants to be seen, and this part is me. Let me know if I'm wrong. He wants to be, like, seen as a real NBA player, and he doesn't seem to feel that he is respected as a real NBA player. And I don't know if that's true. And, of course, I'm saying this from a distance, so it's totally possible that I could be wrong, and I don't know what the interactions are that he has with other players, but I never got the feeling that people viewed Lynn, like, in the way that I view Tim Tebow, right? So, for example, I remember when Tim Tebow had his first game, they played against Miami and won on some drive at the end. And I asked the guy that played in that game, I was like, so what'd you think about Tebow? He said immediately. Immediately, right? Worst quarterback I've ever seen. He's like, look, we lost is what it is, but worst quarterback I've ever seen. And this wasn't a dude that was just being a jerk or a dude that was just prone to hyperbole. Like, he's a coach now. Like, that wasn't, he was just straight up and down. This is the worst quarterback I've ever seen. He had this kind of magical run for that one season and then, you know, didn't start as a quarterback again out here playing baseball. I think he's hurt right now. Anything else. But Tim Tebow was a novelty in a way that Jeremy Lin was not. By the same token, for a lot of people, Jeremy Lin was a novelty in a way that Tim Tebow was not. And I mean, I say novelty because, and novelty feels like an unfair term because it has such a negative connotation, but Jeremy Lin was an Asian guard. We don't really get a lot of those. A significant part of the story of Linsanity was the fact that he was Asian. Like, that is part of the story. Like, Tiger Woods being black and Asian and everything else he say he is part of that story. Like, it was there. There's no way that you could pretend as though that's not an element to this story. Like, that's where it is. He stands out very much for that reason. Tebow did not have a novelty factor, for lack of a better term, like that one. But Lin could hoop. And I don't recall seeing anybody that said that he could not. Like, I found it. People weren't talking about him like they talked about Deli, you know, or some of these other dudes out here. You'd be like, yo, how's that cat in the NBA? I don't think anybody ever really felt that about Lin. Like, he was an NBA player, and I thought that, at least I thought, or I felt, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, that he was respected as an NBA player. But I also think that part of what must have been difficult for him in the NBA was that there had to be a lot of dudes. And I mean, I've been told that there were, but I haven't talked to so many people about this specific issue. But there had to be so many dudes. I mean, there had to be a certain number of dudes in the NBA who looked around during that couple weeks of Linsanity and said to themselves, this is happening because this dude isn't black. Right? That's a big part about why this is so exciting to so many people, is because this guy is not black. Like, there are definitely people for whom it was even better because he was Asian, because if you are Asian and you ain't had this, like, this is great, especially if you're seeking, like, a representation of your identity within American culture, then boom, that's going to be there. That's going to be right there for you. But a lot of it was because, hey, we got a dude who's not black. This is still, after all, America. And so this dude's not black. He gets a lot of love for the fact that he is not black. There's going to be some resentment that builds up in the league as a result. And man, that's got to stink if you're Lin, because all you did was come to hoop. Like, look, if there's anybody that's been under, do you think, I'm asking this as a serious question, do you think that there is anybody in the NBA who, when they showed up at various points in their lives to play pickup basketball, was more underestimated every time he stepped on the floor than Jeremy Lin? Can you name anybody? Like, there ain't no Muggsy Bogues in the league no more. Maybe it would have been him because he was like 5'3". But otherwise, you think there's any dude in the league that when he showed up and was like, I got next, and people are like, what you mean you got next? Who you think got that more than Jeremy Lin? Because I don't think anybody did. Not a single person. Scott Brooks played in the NBA for 10 years, right? I bet you when he was showing up to courts, people were like, oh, okay, I can see it, more than they were with Jeremy Lin. Like, I imagine that for him, playing basketball has been a fairly constant fight for respect from a whole lot of people. And I guess part of it, I imagine a part of what happened when he talked about that is that I don't know if this dude feels like his quest for respect was ever achieved. And man, I do imagine that that would have to be frustrating. Like, if you really felt like that, that your quest for respect was never achieved. And I don't know what it would have taken for him to feel like it was. But if that's the case, yo, that is rough. That really, really, really is rough. And that is the thing that I could imagine in a circumstance where you are very comfortable and you are willing to be at your most vulnerable, like it appeared that he was in that video. That'll break you down, man. That'll break you down. So at once, I do kind of look at it and say, hey, man, you had a run, and a run is all you can ask for. Because that really was my immediate thought on that. I said, oh, man, you had a run. And I said, that was probably my thought before I started talking this out with y'all. Yo, man, you had a run. It's good to have a run. You had a run. But I think most of us crave, to a degree, respect. I know I do. I don't really care if you like me. I demand your respect. That is what I want. I have suffered some pretty significant failures in front of people whose opinions I cared about greatly. But I felt like at every turn I left with the respect of people whose opinion mattered to me. I flunked out of graduate school. I left with the respect of my advisor. And I felt my peers. That mattered a lot to me. I got fired from a bunch of jobs. I left with the respect of those with whom I worked. That was very important to me. I don't know how I would have felt about any of those things if I did not sincerely feel that I left with that respect. Like, I remember, you know, I don't know if I told some of y'all, but I got fired from ESPN once. And look at this firing as a 1-year contract. They didn't renew it. But that just meant that they couldn't fire me because I had a contract. Anyway, my man, Pat 40, Pat works at Yahoo. And I remember he sent me something and he was just like, yo, you are good enough to do this. And that, like, that mattered, man. Like, that mattered a great deal because I needed to know that somebody that mattered to me respected the work that I did. It doesn't sound like Lynn feels that. You know, like when I talk about like having a run, like I would be very curious to know, for example, who are the guys that Lynn interacts with in the NBA? Because the old heads tend to be the ones that give the young guys game and be like, look, man, this is what you need to know about hanging in the league. And no, this is what you know, this is how it goes. And I wonder how much of that has been imparted to him, like what the social dynamics are being who he is in that league. I mean, he's got a common thread with a lot of guys in there, which is the Bible stuff. Like, you can always make friends in a sports league with that. At least one with black people in it. That ain't hard. And so I wish that dude the best. And I think I'm gonna stop saying you had a run, because clearly that ain't what it's about to him. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about Fortnite. But first, hiring is challenging. There's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter, smartest way to hire. All right, Dan, I don't really know you like that, so I'm just going to ask. Are you one of these Fortnite players?
No, sir.
You say that with a measure of pride.
I don't think I've played a video game since freshman year of college, so it's been a minute.
Really? Now, how old are you now?
33.
Oh, man. So you did the full grown-up thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't. Like, my last run of video game playing was on Guitar Hero. I really enjoyed playing Guitar Hero. I even got the drums. Me and my homeboy, he would play the bass. I would play the drums. Like, I really enjoyed it. He would just show up at my house after work and we just break out the kit and we get out there and get it going on the, I think that was the PlayStation 3 or 2. I can't remember. But anyway, like, I enjoyed doing that, but I haven't been much on the video game playing since I became, an adult. And I grew up in effect as an only child because my siblings are a lot older. So I used to play a lot of Tecmo Bowl. You know what I'm saying? I used to play a lot of Madden, a lot of Mortal Kombat. A lot of playing against the computer. See, I didn't grow up in no era with no internet playing. So I don't really, like, there's a whole world of this that I don't really understand. Bruh, I went to dinner a few weeks ago in Atlanta with one of my best friends. Now, this man, 40-something years old, right? And he's there with all his partners. And they all play one of them shoot-em-up video games together. It's not Fortnite. I don't know what it's called. But they all play it together. And so we sitting at the Buffalo Wild Wings. We just posted up. We eating. It's no big deal. And the next thing I know, I hear one of them like, y'all want to do a raid tonight? All right, now, one thing you need to understand about me and kind of the life that I live is I'm still kicking it with the cast that I used to kick it with, by and large, right? I still kick it with some people who, when we used to kick it, probably did some things that they should not have done, right? And I have operated primarily on the assumption that we have all aged out of some of these things, but I still have friends that I have to trust that you're not going to have me out here on some stuff that I can't be out here around no more. Does that make sense? Some places I can't be, some folks I can't be kicking it with, and you got to know who those people are. And so next thing I hear is, y'all want to do a raid? I'm like, yo, what's going on? Bro, they were talking about some video game. Like, they was going to plan and get together, and they was all going to get on the headsets, and they was going to pull off some raid on the video game. And there was one other dude there who didn't know nothing about this video game life, and he was just the same as me. He was like, bro, what are you, like, oh, y'all talking about that video game, right? Like, people really get into these things, man. And one thing I'm not doing is judging you for how it is that you choose to have a good time, all right? If you like to play video games a lot, then you like to play video games a lot. Like, I'm not that dude. Now, is there a disproportionate number of herbs who cite playing video games as their favorite activity? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that you a herb because you enjoy playing the video games. I'm just saying, you know, when you go to the video game store, it's a bunch of herbs up in there. You know this. You know that when you go to, like, the video game events, it's a bunch of herbs in there. That doesn't mean you a herb. That doesn't mean they all herbs. And by the way, herbs are people too. And this doesn't mean that they are bad people, right? So I'm just saying all that so you understand I'm not here to throw shade because I understand a lot of the video game playing population is understandably defensive and thinks that people who don't play video games want to throw shade at them. I detected a wee bit of shade in Dan's voice when Dan talked about how he doesn't play Fortnite. Was there a little bit of shade, Dan?
Definitely.
See, Dan's shading you. I'm not shading you. I promise you I'm not. I'm not being a jerk about that. I'm not shading y'all about the video game thing. But some dude won $3 million this weekend, winning a Fortnite tournament that they played, where they played a U.S. Open, the tennis one. And good for him. I get to work, man. They out here talking about, you know, what do you think about the idea as playing video games as a viable career? And I'm like, did somebody ask me that question with a straight face? Are you serious? And so the argument was, hey, man, you can make $3 million by winning one of these tournaments. Here's the thing, though. Like, and this is where, like, playing these video games, at least the way the things stand presently, is different than athletics in this regard. It's a bunch of dudes out here playing basketball and football making $3 million. And they didn't even have to win no whole damn nothing. All they had to do was come out here and punch the clock. This dude got $3 million, and he had to be like the best of the best. That don't sound like good math to me in terms of how you allocate your time if the goal for you is to get the $3 million. You see what I'm saying? Like, if what you're going for here is I'm trying to get rich playing video games, it doesn't sound to me like you're going to be truly at a place where you can do that for quite a while. Like, it seems to need to be more of an infrastructure set up in order for you to do that. The other thing that to me, because I was like, I don't think it's a good idea to put all your eggs in the I'm going to play ball basket either. Like, that's a bad play for you to make. But I do feel if you don't succeed as a high-level football player, there's a lot more levels that you can fall to in order to get this done, right? Or get, like, to pay your bills. Become a coach of some variety, whether you're coaching people personally, right? Working at little high schools, stuff like that. Like, there just seem to be other ways that you can get in the game and make a living for yourself. I don't think it's a good idea to fully invest in anything that doesn't come with some level of transferable skill. Now, I said on television about the video games that I didn't see what the transferable skills were. Some people hit me the game on it. They were like, yo, you know, team, like, there is a teamwork element that comes from a lot of these games because there'd be, you know, these people doing the raid. Everybody got to talk and communicate. Like, you do have to figure out some of those interpersonal dynamics. Mina Kimes wrote a story about this once, and she made a very interesting point, which was that in attending one of these events, that what she saw that I hadn't really considered, like, that's the benefit of, like, these video game events, is that a lot of these kids have been playing these video games by themselves, now actually hang out with each other. Now, how much they want to hang out with each other on a regular basis, don't have a great answer for that. But there is an element of bringing people together that I, as a person who does not play these games, are probably downplayed and underestimated. Like, I can stand some correcting on that matter. I will just say, though, with all of that in mind, bro, I have no idea how long it's going to be before I can sit out here and start acting like this isn't, like, a little different. You know? I remember this once. I was talking to my brother about this when I was in college. He made a very interesting point. And I was talking about the idea that people are willing to be hazed to be in a band, like the marching band. Like people out here getting beat up to be in the marching band, staying up all night, all this crazy stuff to be in the marching band. And I'm like, psh, to be in the marching band? That's ridiculous. And he's like, yeah, pretty crazy that people want to get beat up to be in a fraternity too. Like how do we decide what is cool enough to make it worth it to be hazed, basically? And I was like, okay, I see your point. I wasn't like I was cool with fraternity hazing either, but I understood the argument that he was making. And you get to a similar thing with the video games. Like I went to a, what's the game called? Overwatch. I went to an Overwatch event at the Barclays Center last summer. And I was talking to a guy and he was an agent. Like he represents the players. Like, yeah, like there is a, like a business infrastructure that's being built around this. I was talking to the guy, you know, with the players and, he represents these players and he was talking to me and he was like, yeah, man, one of my guys, I'm so happy for him. He got to the finals and he had suffered a wrist injury and he had really gone through this serious depression because he'd gone through this wrist injury and he wasn't going to be able to play anymore. So like to be there with him as he came back, you know, from all of this was like, it really felt good to me. And I'm like, wow, one, this is crazy. You're talking about this like this is sports. But then on the other hand, why would this not be more important to him than it would be to the people participating in sports? Like there's nothing like ordained about these sports that make them more important than anything else. You know, so that's like kind of a lens that I kind of have to remember and keep in mind before I start like telling the jokes or anything else about the video game players is just that, yo, it's important to them. And if they rock with it, great. And if there's a bunch of people who want to watch you play video games, I find it to be a wee bit strange. But if that's what y'all want to do, do it, right? Y'all also, by the way, don't need to care what I think about it. I am never going to validate your video game heavy existence. It's just not going to be something that I'm about. It's not going to be something that I care about. I'm not, if you're looking for me to make you feel good about the fact that you, your partners, and a bunch of herbs and some combination are over there playing those video games, I'm just not going to be able to do it. You're going to have to feel good about that within yourself. Will that become like cool down the line? I have no idea. Maybe there will be room for it. Hey, man, 20 years ago, I never would have thought that y'all would think somebody like Drake was cool, but y'all do. Game's changing. 20 years from now, we might wind up with the Drake of video games out here mad sensitive over these wins and losses, but everybody loves it. I don't know. Like, maybe that's the point that we are going to reach. I just personally have not really tried to encourage any more non-intellectual pursuits for children. And what I mean by pursuits is the idea that you're like, yo, I love playing video games. That's what I want to do for the rest of my life. I am going to make a career of it. No, I'm not going to be the guy to encourage those things. That's not me. I don't think it's really good for the world. I don't think it's helping us right now. You know? Like, y'all got a video game that can do something about how hot it is outside? Because if that's what it is, that's cool. You go ahead and do that. I feel like every child that's out here in America right now needs to be putting his mind toward how hot it is outside. Because it's going to be real hot outside right down the line. That's what y'all need to be focusing on. If y'all could come up with a video game called Cool It Now, then I'll be out here recruiting kids to go play that, right? Y'all got a video game called Freon? Like Nature's Freon? I don't know what it is. But y'all want to get on that? That's cool. Sit around this room and shoot people on the video game all day long and hope one day that you can get some money for it? Nope. I personally am not going to be the person to encourage it. And you know what? That doesn't matter even a little bit. Not at all. Doesn't change the world. Doesn't have to change the way that you feel about it. You knock yourself out. I'm just going to tell you right now. If we set this up to where we are legitimately telling people, if you play this video game long enough, you might be rich one day. Ooh, buddy, we are doomed. Yes, our pretentious music to let you guys know it is the next installment of the Right Time Book Club. We are reading Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. Previously, we had Howard Bryan on to talk about the first third of the book. We'll have Mike Freeman, the author of the book, to talk about it next month. Before July, from The Undefeated, we have Lanae O'Neill joining us here. And I thank you kindly for joining us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I also feel like I'm about to tell myself to lower my voice. You have such a soft, delicate voice that makes me feel like I'm hollering.
I know. I'm going to have to put my hand up. Well, it's a book about Jim Brown, so if you're hollering, that probably works.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And also, for those who don't know, Lanae once took a shot at Henny with Marshawn Lynch.
I did. It started my career in sports writing, so... Yeah, I was off to a bang.
Oh, they didn't tell you that in the manual that it doesn't get started till you take your first shot of Henny? That's just the gang?
No, there was all kinds of things that was left out the manual with that one, but, you know, I'll save it for the memoir.
Yeah, no, what interesting thing you said before I brought you in, you were just like, you know, I'm not, like, really a sports writer, right? Like, that was your clear warning for me.
Right.
And I told you, like, no, we're here, we're checking a slightly different box because I think it would be wildly inappropriate to talk about a book about Jim Brown or just talk about Jim in general without talking to a woman about this because I think, and I want to know what you thought about this idea, and Mike talks about it a little in the book, the title of it, the idea of the fierceness and the idea that Jim Brown is a hero, but the book does not position that as though the more onerous things that Jim has done in the middle don't matter. But it does get us to like an odd endpoint of sorts.
I think you're right. And what you're saying is that with him positioned as this hero, these things that he's alleged to have done and have done and gone through wasn't disqualifying, right? That we still are putting him in this stratosphere where he made all these strides in the sport, in civil rights, you know, in the society, and that there was another side to him, and these other things that he did are troublesome, and in a way, although they've been adjudicated, the culture is still wrestling with what we do with guys like this, and wrestling unevenly.
Yeah,
right.
Well, yeah, part of why I wanted to talk about this book is I thought about this when Ali died. I was like, what in the world are we going to do when Jim Brown dies? Because there is no simplicity in dealing with this. And my leaning is that you don't dismiss the things that he did that were overwhelmingly positive. But he is an interesting case, and I think somewhat rare, where the things that he did that were good were of a fairly spectacular magnitude. And the things that he did that were bad were of the exact same magnitude on the other side.
Exactly. And it's going to be a real challenge because in sports we want simplicity, right? You want that hero, that guy that runs, you know, more than 1,000 yards and is an Iron Man and can get out there and shrug off the pain and do all of this. You want that kind of stoicism and uprightness to translate into what he does in his private life, the way he walks through the world. And it completely ignores the ways that one fuels the other. Maybe you don't get to be that fierce guy on the gridiron. You know, that's driven by something. That comes from somewhere. And so this notion that we can have it sort of kind of neat has been disproven over and over. And as you said, with Jim Brown, spectacular on the field and spectacularly awful in so many ways off the field, some of the things that he did.
And the tie that seems to bind it all, though, is a notion of masculinity.
Correct.
Right. For me, it's hard to separate because what brings it all together is that in what some would consider the best and worst ways, this is a portrait of not necessarily what masculinity is, but certainly a very 1960s
performance of it.
Right. And a particularly black power 1960s form of masculinity, because tied to so many of those dudes is a startling level of misogyny.
Well, right. So it's a subset, right? You have masculinity, you have black masculinity, you have black power masculinity, which I would imagine would be different from, say, black artsy masculinity or something like that. But yes, that's the through line, right? So the notion that you are the, you know, this badass on the field, that you go out there and you're punishing men for trying to tackle you, you're dominating them, not just physically, but you know, kind of bending them to your will in terms of plays and strategy. And then, you know, off the field, you have these women, starting with your wife, who he appeared to imply hadn't grown enough with him, right? That as his star got bigger, she wasn't able to evolve and to be more ambitious and to show other sides of her abilities and personalities. At this, by the same token, why do I want a woman who's got her own thing? Why do I want a woman who's not just going to be there and wait for me and, you know, sort of support me? Why would I get married to someone like that? So it's a complete contradiction that doesn't even make any sense, cannot be embodied in one person, and got more and more sort of startling as you went along, as you read the book, as you're like, what? Did he really say that? Even in the 60s and 70s, this was really sort of strong and in a lot of cases ugly stuff.
Yeah, like the interview, I think it was in Ebony that he did talking about his wife, where he talked about those things you mentioned, is that I need a woman that can step out and to do all these things. And I was like, yo, you know she can read this, right? Right. Like, you know, her friends are, you know, her mama's going to see this, right? Everybody got Ebony, bro.
Right. It's, you know, you're going to go down to the barbershop. It's still going to be there probably. And the thing that was so startling about that too is I'm looking, I had to go back, flip through the pages and look again at the date. I was like, yo, they were still married.
Yes.
Like, how are you putting this out in public and how are you sort of feeling entitled, to be able to say these things, which was interesting because it was all about entitlement. Well, not even entitlement, domination. Like he got what he could, you know, take by force. And as his career progressed and he was just given more ground, more of a platform, he just seemed to be able to decide that, hey, I'm going to talk about women. I'm going to talk about Hollywood. I'm going to, use these as an extension of my dominance in sports. And it didn't work as well, nearly as well as when he was talking about sports and civil rights and those kinds of things.
I also thought that you pointed out just there something I thought that was strange in the way he handled it, which was, you want a woman to have all these ambitions while also wanting her to not do anything, which I don't know how that works. Like, I don't know what room was there for your woman to grow when you was gone all the time, right? And she's here with these kids.
Right, exactly. And especially since she had to at least subconsciously know that while you're saying you want her to grow, you really only want that so much, right? Because then that would take away her ability to be there 24/7. With you on command, on demand, and just be there raising your kids while you're off doing whatever you want with whomever you want in public, with no discretion. It was just a lot. I also found it kind of strange though that I didn't get any sense of his wife until really this little, middle third of the book. Right. It was well past page 150 that I even read her name. And I thought that was strange. There were allusions earlier that he was married, you know, he'd be in the car with his wife. But I was like, oh, yo, who is this woman, you know, who's so one dimensional, you know, that she barely merits a mention in the first, you know, half of the book.
Yeah, it seems like he must not have gotten but so much access to the family because you don't really hear that much from the kids. Kids, by the way, that, you know, look at Jim and say, yo, we didn't know our dad either, right? Right?
Right.
Right. As this growing woman was supposed to be out here, Jim ain't hugging his kids. Jim's not doing any of this stuff, which again gets us to this weird notion of like being a man.
Right.
And it also seemed that Jim seemed to be doing a lot of figuring out how to be a man by guessing. Right, because all the men in his life were people who were facilitating his athletic dreams, it seems, at least.
He was trying on these different clothes, these different shoes, these different man suits, and a lot of them just didn't fit, or they fit for being a star football player and the kind of leadership and determination that's required there, but they didn't fit in terms of having functional relationships with the people who are supposed to be the closest to you in your life. There's a not just a fear of intimacy, almost a contempt for it. And so, right, the how am I going to do this? Presumably, he would want to be different from his own absent father, but he ended up replicating the very thing that he grew up with in that absence. And, you know, that trickles down through the kids. You know, later on in the book, I know, the author talks more extensively about his second family. And apparently, you know, that goes a little bit differently. He's a little bit more available. But man, when I was reading this part, I was just like, ooh, this is just rough. These are just flat characters who don't even seem to share in that celebration and that glory and all his achievements.
You know, and you mentioned the second family. I saw Jim 2 or 3 years ago in Miami. I think it was 2 years ago I saw him, and he was with his wife. And, you know, he's older now. I think he did hit 80. And
so yeah, he's walking. He's like 83.
Yeah, like he's walking with a cane now. And when you mentioned intimacy, it hit me is that that's kind of what's left at this point for a man in that position in life. And I wonder how that goes for him as he, you know, because this book was published about 10, 12 years ago. How it goes for him after that fact now, because all that's left in life for him is intimate moments and all the, for someone to care for an 83-year-old man who can't quite get around and requires as much as Jim probably requires, that's all you two have.
Right, right. I think you bring up something really important. She's Generation X, so she's essentially, his wife is essentially caring for an elderly spouse. And, you know, I guess he would have had to learn to be intimate because in so many ways he's got to be dependent on her now in ways that he was wholly unaccustomed to being when he was younger. It's good that you know, he hit 80 and he's still getting around and, you know, we've written about him. He has still his AmeriCan program and out there trying to make a difference. But yeah, wow, what you have is your wife. What you have are your children. You're not on this heavy-duty speaking circuit, traveling the country, getting all these accolades. So you have these intimate moments, and you better have gotten better at them. Otherwise, what's the choice? To die alone?
Right. And this portion of the book also gets into, well, just maybe the, if you ask people one thing they know about Jim Brown specifically, I think they'd have a harder time pointing at one particular football moment and would immediately get to the woman he threw off a balcony. Which no, I did not realize we talked about this coming in, where you said that for a lot of people, the belief was that it was Raquel Welch that he had thrown off the balcony.
You know, I don't know if that was just me. I don't know if that was just the rumor in Chicago or if I just heard it wrong. But somehow in my young mind, I conflated football, Raquel Welch, and balcony. But all of it just added up to a picture of an incredibly singular figure in the popular culture that folks were wrestling with, right? He was past his playing days and prime when I was young and was hearing about him as this actor, as this friend of Richard Pryor, as this man who threw women off balconies. And so it was just incredibly complex and conflated. And you made a point earlier about what are they going to say about him. Those things were difficult to deconstruct, to unpack even then, right? Like, even when you knew less and there was, you know, there were fewer words about him and no social media and any of that, he was still, people didn't know how to process those things going together. And I think, again, folks want simplicity, so he's a star who just, you know, had to knock around his woman a little bit. But the balcony thing was an extremity.
Yeah, and it's interesting that that's just a sentence. Like, and you know, and I say this as someone who has received Jim and had, you know, my it's a process in figuring out what I think about all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, like what I thought in 2006, for example, is not necessarily the same as what I think now. But that really was just a sentence. Oh yeah, there was that one time that he threw a woman off a balcony.
Right.
Because we have to keep going to get to the other stuff.
Right.
And I think it speaks a lot to how we talk about women or how we feel about women as a society, because even white people are just going past this. It's like, okay, it's just another sentence in it. Like with this revolutionary type of figure who was trying to dominate, like, economically, right? Who was going for, I guess, a self-sufficiency argument that can be easy for a lot of white people to support because it takes responsibility away from them, but also seizing power back from people. And he threw this woman off a balcony. Now, granted, it was a black woman, so maybe that affects the way that it was received, but he throws this woman off the balcony and it's just a sentence.
Right. And I want to go back to something you just said, even white people, I would say especially white people, because the things that he was bringing to the popular culture, to people's bottom lines, right? The value add of a Jim Brown on your football team and then in your movies to add this exoticism or, you know, whatever. And then the fact that it's politically palatable for him to say, you know, up by your bootstraps, we need all this economic self-determination without languaging. I'm sure he recognized it, and he did say it in various parts, but the structural inequalities that are just baked in the system. But that uplift message was something they could get behind. So especially white people who have, you know, the mainstream culture has its own long and intimate relationship with violence against women. So, yeah, that got completely glossed over in some ways, as you said, just as a sentence, just as an aside, as a comma of apposition. Oh, you know, Jim Brown, great football player, Hollywood star, civil rights activist. He threw that woman off the balcony that time, and then him and Richard Pryor are real good friends, right. You know? Yeah.
And it even as in the last, you know, 2-3 years or so, we have reckoned with some of these matters a bit differently. And when Jim did something that was wildly unpopular among black people, which is his support for
Nixon.
Donald Trump. Oh. Yeah, he did Nixon too, right?
Right.
But even after that, it right. still remained a sentence. Like, I'm not even saying that people necessarily care that much about violence against women, but we will throw this stuff out right. as an excuse against people we don't like all the mm-hmm. time. It didn't, like, it didn't come up then. And also in reading this book, something that comes up kind of, not, I don't know if subtly is the right way to put it, but relationships with underage women.
How about that?
Are pretty mentioned like more than once. I'm getting one pregnant, I know, comes up in the course of the book. And even then, there's still sentences in the larger right. Jim Brown narrative. And it is fascinating that it has existed as such.
It is, isn't it? And stuff that, again, would be disqualifying for others as we're having these reconsiderations and these reckonings with people's past, with, you know, Al Franken who kissed too many people or something like that. You have this whole ass celebrity with this enormously troublesome backstory and complicated history. As you said, that includes underage women, which the woman he's alleged to have gotten pregnant and completely denied, went to court about, Brenda Ayers, right. in the book, and then admitted, you know, later that, yeah, he did, in fact, father a child with this woman.
And, in fact, woman is a stretch because I think she was 15.
I think, well, when she went to court, she was 18.
Right.
And there was no mention of her prior to
right.
18. So who knows
gotcha.
when you know, all the freaky haps are alleged to have happened.
Yes.
But it's part of what is problematic about a reconsideration and this moment in that it is so unevenly applied, right? And so we don't have a template for judging someone like a Jim Brown because we can say all these other things about him that are not exclusively athletic, but about what he meant to the culture and that subset we were talking about earlier, manhood and black power. So that perhaps renders him more Teflon, right? That's an untouchable thing. White commentators, maybe even in this reconsideration, don't want to leave themselves open to charges of racism or just not getting it, right? And, you know, black folks, in some ways and in some quarters, haven't reached a place where we feel healed enough and secure enough in our person and secure enough in these streets as in our citizenship to go after someone who so clearly stood up for us. So those contradictions, those are tough to wrestle with.
Yeah, and I wish and I think about this very often just in this business that it not be such a requirement that we can like put together a one sheet on somebody, right?
Right.
Like that we can try to sum them up in one sentence because I think I long ago made terms with the fact that good things happen to bad people all the time. And I also came to terms with the fact that like, Jim is so wildly impressive, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even if you know, and I don't want it to make it seem like I'm saying separate all the bad stuff, but like, if Jim Brown were to walk into a room and you talk to Jim Brown and like, you look at the football clips or just look at the clips of him talking or just look at him standing or just look at him in a suit, like all of these things, You know that that's the dude that you know the second that he walks in the room. He doesn't have to talk loud. And when he has things to say, there are things that are worth hearing. Like, he is unquestionably an impressive figure. And you can also be an impressive figure who has done awful things. And I think that where people find guys like him to be, the word we like to use is compelling, is, yeah, it's really compelling that this guy could be so impressive but also do awful things, except these two things aren't, they're not, at once it's kind of like they're not related, but also they're not separate. Like, you know, it's just, if we need to make him simple, this is going to be hard. If we can take these things, beating women as an individual thing, and his fight for civil rights as its own individual thing, this actually gets pretty simple.
Right. Right. Well, and separating them, I think you're right, is the wrong thing to do. They're all blended up together. They all make the person, in the same way that, you know, George Washington and the apocryphal story of his cherry tree or his heroics on the battlefield. He also had a mouthful of false teeth that he got from one of his enslaved people.
Right.
Right.
By the way, that is not an exaggeration for the people who heard that are like, you must be crazy. No, they would take the teeth out the slaves' mouths and
that?
Put them into masses.
Who were presumably still using them.
Yeah. That's
right. I feel like they didn't give, you know, permission, or, you know, they didn't say, hold up, I'm, you know, I got lunch coming up, right, or something like that, that wasn't a power that they had. Right. Right. And the answer is, I don't care, you know, tote that barge, bail that hay, whatever. But point being, something we went back to earlier, these kinds of reconsiderations, they're uneven. They get applied to some people and not to others, for some things and not to other things, for some things for some people, not to, for other things to other people. And so blending this stuff together is the only way moving forward that we're going to be able to make sense out of all of this. And it won't be a one sheet. Right. There'll be volumes, and that's all of us. If we took a microscope to our lives, and, you know, his was an outsized life. His was is a hyperbolic life. And so you're going to have to make peace with the fact that you can't make an easy peace with some of these things.
And I tell you, that Fox News obituary when Jim Brown dies, boy, it is going to be, you know, it's coming. It's got to come now. It's on the way.
They're writing it now. Listening to us as we speak.
It is all the way. The tweet has already been drafted.
Like, how about that?
Everything is ready. That is Lanae O'Neill. Check her out at theundefeated.com. I thank you so much for joining us here in studio for this. That was very kind of you.
Thank you so much, Bomani. It was great to be here.
All right. I appreciate it. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Dan. Dan, tell me your last name.
Stanzik.
There we go. I'd only read it off a piece of paper. There was a few more consonants than I was prepared to handle on the fly. Thank you. Dan Stanzik handled everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you also to our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. And be sure to check out the Woj Pod this week, where he chats with Denver General Manager Arturis Karnisova. Also, remember, subscribe to The Right Time and the Woj Podcast wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And I'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.